welcome to Criterion
Close Up.
I am Mark Herney, and I'm here with my co-host, as always, Mr. Aaron West. Aaron, how are you?
I'm great. Happy Thanksgiving and Black Friday.
Yes, same to you. Happy Turkey Day and shopping, spending more money than we should. But hey, we saved money when we were spending money, right?
I saved a ton of money this week.
It's all that matters. Yeah. Welcome, everyone, again, to Criterion Close-Up, Episode 17. Today, we're going to be talking about the Brian De Palma film from 1981, Dressed to Kill. And we'll have an extended news and segment, as well as a film discussion. We don't have a subtopic, so it kind of gives us a little bit of extra breathing room. So It's cool. Look forward to that.
And probably should mention we're recording on Black Friday. So we're going to probably talk about some sales that will be long gone by the time you guys listen to this.
Yeah. But hopefully you can live vicariously through the sales and what we purchase. I'm sure you grab some of your own stuff. So.
And some of them are around all weekend, too. So maybe some will be there.
Still going. So, well, it just behooves people to listen to the show early, right?
That's right.
So, and as always, in our opening segment, we just have a few kind of updates. We wanted first to thank Christina and Ruth last week for joining us for the blogathon aftermath. Really enjoyed that discussion. It was great to give out the awards, and we got a lot of good feedback regarding that discussion. So thank you, Christina, Ruth, and of course, Aaron, the major mastermind behind that endeavor, really did a great job.
Yeah, so. I think they pumped me up too much. They were very, very much involved. They were being humble. But
so, yeah. And we had a nice comment, especially from when Criterion posted this on their site. There were a few comments in there, and there was one in particular that we wanted to highlight.
Yeah, and Christina and Ruth told me to read, or not told me, but advised or suggested I read the comments, mm-hmm. and I hadn't. And they were really nice. And there was one that really caught my eye, and it's a little long, but I'm going to go ahead and read it here. And it's not really about us, but it's just about Criterion. And I really thought it kind of captured the spirit of the blogathon. Criterion has never failed when it has made widely available to generations both new and old some or most of the most unique and compelling films in the history of cinema, and giving critics of both generations, amateur and professional, a chance to offer insightful critiques of their own on each film that is released. With the Criterion Blogathon, it goes one step further in allowing more established fans and neophytes to build on and contribute their own perspectives to film appreciation. Andy Warhol once said that the movies have been teaching America what to do from the beginning, to which I may add, the Criterion Collection, since its humble beginnings in 1984, has been teaching the world of filmmakers, critics, historians, and cinephiles what they might have missed from first watching these cinematic treasures or whatever films they have yet to see and must see before they die. The blogathon will not merely add to this tradition, it will enhance it by encouraging all who believe in true cinema to make their views known and prove that films, especially those in the Criterion Collection, are not to be viewed merely as a medium of escapist entertainment, but in general as a true, spiritual, and transcendent form of eternal art. Whew, that was a mouthful.
Yeah, that was a great mouthful, though. That was I couldn't say it any better. Really nice to see that. Couldn't agree more.
It was nice. I will say that, throwing the till we die part, and also that he threw the word neophyte in there, and I'd say that we had very few neophytes. We had maybe just a couple, and I think people think of neophyte as a negative term for amateurs, but we do have some young people that are just beginning their journey, and so that might apply to them. But no, we had all types, and
Yeah, I really appreciate that. I love seeing the quote-unquote neophytes, too. I love seeing young people into these kinds of films. It's just such a testament to what's there. So, great stuff. So that's lovely. Again, the blogathon wrap-up. Moving into, as we set off the top, what's been going on the past couple of days. Again, happy Thanksgiving and Black Friday. And so there are a number of sales out there. We just wanted to briefly highlight that we thought we'd mention. Maybe you want to check them out. Maybe you've already bought some stuff. So there's currently a sale from Eureka Entertainment. And it's actually, that's from the UK. And of course, they are they have their own site, Eureka Entertainment. They're also, they sell some discs on Amazon UK. So if you want to get some Masters of Cinema discs, or some other ones from Eureka. Definitely worth checking those out. I think that goes through the weekend. There's also an Arrow Films sale that they're actually bundling a number of films. Like I saw some from Vincent Price, the Baravchek set, really the separate releases, the two steelbooks from Cronenberg. I was kind of eyeing that with Shivers and Rabbit, although I already have one. But have you picked up anything from either of those ones yet, Aaron?
Yeah, what's weird is Black Friday, I always look at Amazon first, our Amazon, sure. And usually there'll be some good deals on new films or recent films and some classic films. Actually, sometimes there have been Criterions in the Lightning Flash sales. But this year, I didn't get it. I got a couple things from, I got Akira, was $10. That's one.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So I did go, and we're both Region B enabled. There was a sale on Region B players that we tweeted earlier. So actually, I recommend, you know, it's going to hurt your wallet, but you kind of expand your horizons. And,
yeah, there's some good stuff out there. And even just getting different editions, like I mentioned, the Steelbook for Cronenberg, you know, it just kind of opens your availability to buying different types of titles and packaging, but also, of course, like you said, opens your wallet a little bit. But
a little bit, yeah. So I did Eureka Masters of Cinema, they have this this storefront on Amazon Co. UK called Best Media Group, and I don't know why, I just don't like to order from their website, so I think I got like four titles from there, City Girl, just a couple that I wanted. And then I wasn't, when I saw the bundles from Arrow, I was going to pass at first, and then I looked at them closer.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, I saw the Mario Bava, and I was like, okay, I own three of these, why would I buy this? But right. Then I looked, I saw Vincent Price, I owned none of them, and it's actually a great, it's seven films, and then I saw the Jules Dassin.
And
I bought both of those, even though I have Rififi on Criterion and Night in the City. And I don't know why. It was a good price. And
You get the Blu-ray, and, you know, maybe Criterion will release it at some point. But like you said, it's a great price. Why not?
And you can always, they sell too. You could always put them online and sell them on eBay or Amazon. So
yeah, I didn't grab any of those. Actually, I was surprised that I had all the Masters of Cinema stuff really I needed, except for the brand new stuff. That stuff didn't really drop in price. And looking at the Arrow stuff, the only thing I really needed was Shivers, because I had, you know, a couple titles. Like for Vincent Price, I've already got the Shout Factory release or Scream Factory release. So unfortunately didn't, you know, jump in, but you know, I'm saving a little money.
There will be another Arrow sale in a couple weeks, which will have, they won't be bundled up. They'll be individual titles. So if you're in, there's going to be some good stuff probably for, you know, between £5 and £10. And I found that, you know, when you, even with shipping, it's usually cheaper buying that route than it is, you know, buying a new Criterion. So it's, it's not too bad. Oh, one more thing. I did, they had an MST3K marathon yesterday for Thanksgiving, and I did geek out on that some. And they're doing their Kickstarter, and it's not specifically related to this podcast, but I think most film aficionados would appreciate what they do. There was one I watched called Iga that had Richard Kiel in the 60s. And there was a reference to White Heat, and then there was a reference to the Third Man. They throw a lot of references, and as I've gotten older, I pick up on these a lot
you
more.
You get the references more,
When I was 15, I didn't know. I hadn't seen.
I think that's why we were talking about this before, and it's why I didn't really like the show when I was younger, but I would appreciate it much more now, I think.
Yeah, well, it's funny. They're bringing it back, and there'll be new episodes that'll be a little different and probably not as good. Yeah, I mean, maybe they will be as good, but the old episodes, there are some treasures. And so they had a half off, and so I spent a little to buy what will eventually be digital downloads of their shows. And I think I'm going to do like you know how Doug has his Zatoichi Fridays?
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm going to do MST3K Fridays.
Nice.
Or
nice.
Riftrex, which is the same thing with,
cool,
you know, later, so.
That's a great idea. How about cinema? There's a Cinema Guild sale going on right now through the weekend. That's half off everything. There's also, you know, the Amazon stuff you mentioned. The only thing I picked up there was I did get Volver It's kind of hovering around $6 anyway, the Almodovar film. So I finally grabbed that. I picked up, just to be complete with Sin City for some reason, I grabbed the 3D version of that. It was on sale. And for the kids, I picked up the Karate Kid set. That was very early on. So, you know, I actually, it is probably the least spending I've done on a Black Friday on Blu-rays for some time, which is good with the Criterion sale going on.
All right, so did you get anything from Barnes & Noble?
I did. I picked up, just today I got the Louis Malle Eclipse set, number 2 there. Also ordered a couple things online with a 30% off coupon, the Human Condition and Monsters and Mad Men. So
guess what?
I grabbed those.
Me too. I got both of those.
Nice.
Oh, and I should mention I got the Kinoshita Eclipse, so I'm Eclipse complete now. And so I'm like, oh, what do I buy? And well, I bought those two.
DVD sets.
Yeah, maybe just occasionally I'll buy because they just don't get upgraded. I don't know why. But
yeah. There was a discussion on Twitter about this recently. I think, you know, Scott and I was from Criterion Cast was weighing in. And just there hasn't been that many upgrades. We've got the Cassavetes, but you know, not many others. So
yeah, I was in that conversation and I thought about it afterward, and the Samurai trilogy did get updated. Upgraded,
right.
But that was a really early Criterion too, and those were really bad prints. So,
right,
yeah, and there haven't been too many. Supposedly, there's going to be the War trilogy someday. Although, you know, really, that's not a given.
Yep, sure. You know, you would expect, you know, Dreyer and the Dwanel series. Those are both on Blu-ray in the UK. So maybe I think it's Artificial Eye or BFI and then Artificial Eye respectively, but.
But 400 we'll Blows came out separately, and there's a Bergman sets. They broken those up, so yeah.
Right.
I don't think they're always going to just upgrade those. Maybe a handful.
See what happens. Yeah. If anyone's a fan of Shout Factory, there is a sale going on there too. This kind of seems to come up quite a bit, but they're like 15% off if you buy $80 plus. Mm-hmm. So there's a coupon code called In the Bag. So I just got an email for that. So you know, little Black Friday sale for them too. So moving on into our podcast week, we were a little bit active this past week outside of our normal Criterion close-up episode. So first, I had a guest stint on the Talk Film Society podcast. This one was hosted by Marcello Pico, and he does a podcast. He also has a Facebook group that I just signed up for. I just noticed today. And so it's a Society for Film Lovers on Twitter. And he says, if we follow you, you're a member. And so he does with his podcast is he has a regular host, but he'll also have a regular co-host, but he'll also have other folks on to, you know, talk about whatever the film is. And he's kind of he'll get to know you through Twitter. And he got to know me as a Criterion fan through Twitter and invited me on. He'd had a show in July where he and his co-host, I believe it's Matt, talked about their top 10 favorite Criterions. And so on this one, we talked a little bit back and forth about what we wanted to review, something a little bit underseen for Criterion. And so we went with Repo Man.
Good one.
Had a nice, you know, about 30-minute discussion there. So. Yeah, it was really cool to talk to him. He's been buying Criterion as long as I have, about 5 years, and but he hasn't luckily gone as crazy as I have with buying as many. So I think he's a little less nuts than I am. But so we had a good discussion there. So we'll could include that a link to that in the show notes. Folks want to check that out.
Yeah, and I think it came out yesterday, so I haven't had a chance to listen to it. So.
Yeah, just posted on Thanksgiving. So,
but I will definitely, it's top of my list. A lot of podcasts, including our own, will be stacked up. So, yeah.
A lot of good listening. And Aaron, you had a nice conversation. I did check that out yesterday on 310 to Yuma.
Yeah, I was talking to myself. Billy Idol was dancing with himself. I was just talking. I did not dance during that podcast. But 310 to Yuma, yeah, it's a shortcut, and you know these really are shortcuts. You know, I just try to isolate a few themes, and you know, I think you called it a blog, an audio blog. I think that's a fair description. I don't get as in depth as we do, but I enjoy it. It's a film like this where there's some clips I can pull and integrate makes it, I think, work pretty well, and that's somebody to talk to.
Yeah, yeah, it sounded great. I really liked your take on it. And it is, you know, a really great film, one folks should check out. And if you haven't, you know, check it out and listen to the podcast. It sounds good.
I liked it, yes.
So we had a call last week for our Facebook page. We're getting close, Aaron. We're at 997. So trying to get to that 1K.
I think we'll be there past the weekend. It's a holiday week, but I think the APB worked a little bit. Yeah, I think we got maybe 20 something. So, and then so you'll have to get us to 2,000, and then 20,000.
Yep. Yeah, we'll get to the 20K. Maybe another year.
Yeah, another decade maybe.
We'll see what happens, but yeah, I appreciate folks definitely, you know, send the link out. Invite your friends who are film fans or podcast fans to check it out. We'd love some more likes. So thank you. Lastly, before the news, wanted to just give a schedule update. So we are going to be delving into the Apu trilogy, spending some time there in one form or another. We're hoping to maybe do Aparajito as a Criterion close-up full episode next week. Maybe a shortcut on Padre Panchali in between there, maybe next week. And then, of course, getting into the last film, Apur Sansar, and really an Apu trilogy wrap-up. So have that to look forward to.
Yeah, I guess we're going to immerse ourselves in the Apu world. Well, I've already been there. I've already reviewed it, but it's a good place to go back to.
Yeah, you know, a little discussion there. It'll be fun. I can't wait for that. I saw Pather on the big screen, and so can't wait to delve into the special features on this one.
And then we do have a mystery guest in December I mentioned. That is awesome. Very awesome. We also have a few 2016 shows. I thought I might be a good time to mention. We're going to do a double feature, Breaker Morant and Mr. Johnson, which I think we'll touch on post-colonialism. We're going to do a double feature, Inside Llewyn Davis and Don't Look Back, Bob Dylan. I think that'll be a good fit.
Yeah, those will tie together nicely.
And we're gonna do a gross out film podcast. So I think the main topic will be Antichrist, Lars von Trier, and then the subtopic will be
everything else. Yes. Sallow.
I'm dreading that one.
Serbian film, maybe. Yeah.
Maybe, yeah. We have more double features. We have Naked and Life is Sweet, which has been requested. I think we're gonna finally do that. We might do Out One. I think we're gonna do a Limelight and a Chaplin episode, which will be a very long episode. Yeah. But I think it'll be a very good episode on Chaplin, I think. Valerie and her Week of Wonders, and I think we're gonna talk about the Czech New Wave. And this is going through April, maybe even May, depending on scheduling.
Right.
But I think we have some good ideas and gonna be a lot of fun.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Some nice pairings there, so especially the Gross Out episode. That's going to be fun to plan. Yeah. Any suggestions folks have, you know, we'll take them.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, that's it for, again, just for a little bit longer, but housekeeping since we have a little extra time. So let's jump into the news. It is a slower news week because of the holidays, of course. People are buying stuff, showing off their purchases. Love seeing those pictures on the different Facebook groups and Twitter. Mm-hmm. So very cool.
Yeah, now that I'm complete or mostly complete, I've been the guy showing off those pictures, but I'm not now. So, but it's cool to see, you know. Oh yeah, I remember what that was like.
yeah, it's nice. It's the excitement of just within the picture. It's nice to see. So, yeah. So wanted to mention this week's release coming out on Tuesday, so it's December 1st, will be Downhill Racer. So this is the debut feature from Michael Ritchie, stars Robert Redford. So looking forward to that.
Important Sundance film. I think that'll be an interesting one. I'm getting it next week. I don't know about you.
Cool. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'll probably wait a little bit, but we'll see. I saw a review on Criterion Forum is up. It's saying the picture quality, you know, good release. They weren't stellar on it, but we'll see. We'll make our own judgment.
Sure.
So we'll see what happens.
A lot of times those old indies are tough to get the picture quality just because the originals are not tip top. So yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Like
yeah.
I watched the Arrow Hellraiser set, and some of the picture quality there was a little grainy, but, you know, it was a low-budget horror film from the, you know, the mid-80s, so...
Right. Yeah, sometimes hard to tell if it's the, you know, the elements or the transfer. A lot of times, like you said, it's the elements.
Yeah,
So the Barnes & Noble sale, as folks know, is ongoing. So there currently is a 30% off coupon. I believe it's BF Friday, or actually, I think it's 30B Friday. 30B Friday. So you can use that online. There's also, if you go to the site there, the Barnes & Noble site, you can print there a coupon to bring into the store. So if you maybe you have a, you can, if you're not a member, you can use 30%. If you are a member, you get an extra 10%.
But actually, this show won't be out till tomorrow, so that helps you. Not at all. But there'll be a Cyber Monday coupon, from what I understand.
I think it's supposed to be 25% there too. So So another thing to use.
One thing I've noticed is that people buying from the website have reported that the Apu trilogy and Akiru have been out of stock. And I did check Apu earlier, and it was in stock, but I think there were just a few copies there. And Akira was out of stock. So, you know, getting towards the end of the sale, but apparently those are popular titles.
Yeah. And, yeah, I can. I mean, when I went to, when I picked up Apu the first day it came out, there was only one or two left, I think, when I went that Tuesday. And same with Akira. I picked it up on in store, again, the release date, and they had probably six. Don't look backs, but the I picked up the last Akiru, and I was there, I think, you know, the end of the day, like 5 o'clock. So, yeah, popular title.
People love that movie, and people love Kurosawa. He sells.
Yep. So, and just wanted to mention again, I did a little field reporting, did finally get to my Costco, and just as folks want to, if you're thinking about something for a loved one or maybe for yourself, the Hitchcock set and the Rock set are still at Costco. So we've been talking about those. I won't even mention the titles again, but it was funny. I when I was there looking at the discs, I actually almost missed it because it was like buried under some other discs. So if you're looking for it, dig a little bit. Maybe it's not too prominent. So
yeah, they look great.
So. And I wanted to mention, there is another sale going on right now. This actually goes through next week. I think it's Friday then at 3. So through December 4th at 3. This is through the Entertainment AIDS Alliance. So, and there are some cheap Criterion movies there. There's also, you know, a few other titles. But this thing, it's a nonprofit that was founded in 1989 to respond to the urgent need for funding for AIDS service providers. And over 80% of the funds raised are distributed to qualifying HIV AIDS research and healthcare organizations nationwide. So it's a good organization, and there are a number of labels that have donated items directly for their sale. And there are some titles from Criterion that were there. They were one of the donors. So as far as the titles, there's a few there, a couple have sold out, and they range anywhere from $4 to $8. So worth checking it out. I know that you do have to pay for shipping, but support a worthy cause for the Entertainment AIDS Alliance sale, again, going through December 4th.
Yeah, and it's not just Criterion, too. There's a lot of discs for sale, and you know, some are $3, some are $10. I think some of the newer releases were like $15, but
sure.
Yeah. You might find some bargains in there just going through, and we'll put a link in the show notes.
Cool. So some sad news this holiday season. We did lose the great Setsuko Hara this past week. Very unfortunate. She's the legendary actress. She passed away just this week. Of course, as folks know, she's worked with Ozu and Kurosawa, some other directors too, like Naruse. But I was sorry to see this. I guess it was, you know, not originally announced, and the news kind of came late from her family. But
She actually died in September, so it was
unfortunate.
She did lead a really private life, kind of strange. She pulled away from films after Ozu passed, and I didn't think she was living in solitary, but you know, of course she was 95. She lived a long life, so maybe. But you know, she didn't do interviews. People, you know, didn't really see her for many, many years.
Right.
So hopefully, she, you know, the second and third chapters of her life were enjoyable, and she got what she needed. But yeah, we remember her from those great old 50s and 60s movies and 40s too. Yeah, one of the greats, maybe the great of Japanese cinema. Just amazing.
Sure. Yeah.
And we talked about the Ozu films a lot, but there are a couple. You mentioned Naruse. Sound of the Mountain is an amazing movie, and is that out? I think that's only a Region B release. Is that Masters of Cinema?
I think it was. It may even be part of that out of print set. I'm not sure, but
it might be. Yeah, it's a great film, and one that's that you can see on Hulu is Kurosawa's post-war film No Regrets for Our Youth. I think that was 45 or 46, and that is a very good movie. And I think that's where the censors finally came off, and he was able to really say what he wanted to say in film. And that's an early performance for her, but you could see that she definitely had the acting chops, and it's strange to see such a young Hara.
Yeah, so I mean, really sad news. I've only seen Late Spring, so it's just hopefully a good excuse to check those out. And folks, there is a Criterion tribute. It does include the piece from the Late Spring.
That was nice.
Actually from the DVD there from Donald Ritchie, so that's definitely worth giving a read.
Yeah, it's weird that a 95-year-old passing would hit you so much, but yeah, this one really did. And so yeah, she was a special lady.
Yeah, sorry to see that. The next thing we wanted to mention is there is as of yet unconfirmed, but there is a little controversy about the Code Unknown discs. This was posted on Reddit. So a message, someone had messaged John Mulvaney, someone had emailed or somehow found out from the mysterious John Mulvaney that they're aware of a potential issue, maybe a skipping or drop frames at certain points during the disc.
Yeah. I think the folks over at Criterion Forum, snooped this out, but apparently, and you know, I didn't notice this when I was watching, but apparently there's some frames dropped, like maybe four or five times during the film. I think that's, you know, one frame missing in full motion, you're probably not going to pick up on it, but some people do get upset about that.
Right.
I don't know if Criterion needs to do anything. I don't know if they will. They might just blow it off.
We'll see. Probably more to come on that one.
Probably. It doesn't seem as big as, well, as coincidence has it, the Dress to Kill disc issue, since
right.
We're talking about it today, which I looked fine to me.
I didn't notice any no stretching on Dress to Kill.
Well, there was stretching, but
we'll just leave that one there. I wanted to mention there is another post on the Criterion site. John Waters visited, and there's just a brief video on him. He's recommending what did he call it? A heartwarming Christmas story he recommends for the whole family.
Yeah, it was kind of cool that he was sitting in the lobby of Criterion, and that's really, when you go into Criterion and the left, it's a lobby. It's a waiting room where, just like any company. And that's where I was at earlier this year. He was there. It might have been part of the same visit, but they posted a picture of him and Angela Lansbury a couple weeks ago, and of course, the joke was nobody could have foreseen that pair being together.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know if John Waters stuff is Criterion, if it's their type. I mean, he's a cult icon. There's some, he has a huge fan base. Very, very rabid fan base. I was trying to think of films that could be a fit, and I was thinking maybe Hairspray, late 80s, I forget the year.
Sure, yeah.
Maybe paired with a shampoo.
yeah, double feature.
A hair product, sometimes they do that. They like these little puns.
It would make a nice, wacky drawing or something, so we'll see.
Yeah, it would, yeah. Well, we might find out here, the end of the month is nigh, and then the end of the year is just a few weeks away, and we'll get a lot of clues coming up. But yeah, maybe not, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Eating Raoul is in the collection, and that's kind of a niche cult classic, sort of, so why not Hairspray?
Yeah, we'll see. So that's it for our news. So Aaron, I'm going to just go ahead to the museum. I've got some artwork to check out, so I'm going to take a quick break, and can we come back and We'll talk about Dress to Kill. I'll just let you know, you're going to hear my footsteps a little bit. So. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Criterion Close-Up. I am Mark Kearney, and I'm here with Aaron West.
Hey, Mark, you dropped this glove when you were in the museum. Did you... I think there's somebody in a taxi has it. You want to go get it?
Yeah. I'll go in there and see what happens.
All right, well...
Little rendezvous.
Maybe so. It won't be
Andy. I guess this museum is going to be a little more exciting than I originally planned.
Yes, Philadelphia Museum of Art, is that right?
That sounds right.
That might not be the exact name, but it's in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But I think the streets were in New York, so imagine that.
That's right. Yeah, she did mention that. Yeah, I can't imagine. That was a really cool scene. So if folks haven't picked up already, if you've seen the movie, I'm sure you have. We are talking about Dress to Kill, the 1980 film. It's a Spy Number 770 from Brian De Palma. Has an interesting cast. We've got Michael Caine, Angie Dickinson, Nancy Allen, Keith Gordon, Dennis Franz. And the synopsis, it revolves around the grisly murder of a woman in Manhattan. There we go. And how her psychiatrist,
spoiler,
her brainiac.
We'll get right. Is that from the back cover?
It is. It is. This is from the Criterion.
We don't spoil anyway, but we don't care anymore about spoiling. But if it's on the Criterion cover, it's fair game. Although that's you know, not even a third or midway through the movie or so.
Yeah, it's the first third. You know,
is it?
It's
okay.
It might even be sooner than a well known Hitchcock movie. But probably, you know, I bet if you timed it out, knowing De Palma, it's probably at the exact same time.
Bet it is. Yeah.
But the other part to mention, it's so that her brainiac teenage son and the prostitute who witnessed the crime try to piece together what really happened while the killer remains at large. So, yeah, I mean, this was a film that, was this the first time you'd seen it, Aaron?
No, not technically. I had seen it when I was younger, but I definitely did not see the same,
cut.
Definitely not the same cut. And, and I saw it when I was very young, and I didn't have this film background or hadn't seen all these films since then. So I didn't really understand what De Palma was doing. The museum scene probably didn't work as well for me back then, but
it
works now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I hadn't. If I'd known about this film when I was younger, I certainly would have sought it out, being a young boy. But no, it was my first time to watch it with my wife, and we both, 1980 film. My wife's a child of the 80s, so we figured we'd check it out, and it was well worth it. I think the audiences loved this film. Mm-hmm. Critics liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not quite as much, but it was a big, big hit. And it seemed like, everything worked from the script through the casting per, how De Palma fell. He seems pretty, pretty proud of this one.
Mm-hmm.
Some folks, of course, have accused De Palma of misogyny, and of course, some compare him to Hitchcock. But
he was married to Nancy Allen at the time, and we found out that he wrote the role for her. That was in the supplements. So misogyny. I thought you were gonna. I heard it as nepotism, but there's right. Some misogyny there as well.
You could certainly see that. This was, the movie, the first thing we of course have got to talk about De Palma in this film, and just about his career a little bit. Is this really his peak period? What are some of his influences, as I had already mentioned, I think it's written on his sleeve, the influence of Alfred Hitchcock. I guess I'll kick it to you, Aaron. What did you think about this film as it fits within his career? I mean, we've got Carrie is here, Sisters, which is also, I believe that was his first feature. That's also in the collection. And you had you know, Blowout came after this. Mm-hmm.
Scarface was not just a few years after, and so
right.
And that one's kind of divisive too. It's that one's more populist, and I guess it was critically acclaimed, but some, you know, big time film people snub it a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
Or turn their noses up to it. I'd say this was a pretty impressive stretch in his career. Really until 87, Untouchables, I think. And he is a director that does tend to, he makes no secret that he loves film, and he makes no secret that he does lift shots from films. You know, the most notable is Untouchables, the Odessa Steppes Battleship Potemkin. It's almost shot by shot with the baby carriage going down the stairs. Do you know that shot?
Right. Yep.
So yeah, he's
iconic.
Yeah, and there's also there is Hitchcock, and there's some giallo. Italian giallo there's some influence there, especially in this one.
Certainly I see that.
I could see it in Carrie as well, but not so much the others. Student of film, if the two of us were talking to him in 1973, he could just keep up with us and talk about film like any other film geek. So
right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, he really is. I mean, he just happens to be a guy that's making films. He certainly is a film geek. And I did note what some of the comparisons that Ebert made between Hitchcock and De Palma. I mean, I think some people might call De Palma a hack, because of mm-hmm. all of these influences. I personally don't. I just like his, he's got the timing for suspense that he has and the way he composes shots. There's obviously some talent there. And even though, you know, he does show his influences on his sleeve, I think he's got his own voice. He's, doing his own thing. And like you said, it's not just straight up Hitchcock. It's also... Mm-hmm. The giallo films you can see, but he does have, comparing to Hitchcock, he's got the precise camera movements, the meticulously selected visual details. This is from Ebert, and I just thought, it's a good way to compare characters seen as types rather than personalities. You certainly see that, with the cast. And violence as a sudden interruption of the most mundane situations, going on an elevator.
Yeah, he actually kind of defended himself against the Hitchcock in his interview on the disc, or maybe it was in the documentary. I think he likes to think of, probably he's a guy that's heard that throughout his career, that he's a hack and a Hitchcock poser. There are definitely, he's certain, I think any suspense filmmaker in the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s is influenced by, and even today, influenced by Hitchcock.
Right, can't help but not be.
And I'm with you, it doesn't bother me at all that he's influenced. And in fact, frankly, I think really a lot of the modern auteurs do steal shots from films they love or are heavily influenced. Should I mention Quentin Tarantino? He's a fan of film.
Yeah, exactly.
Steven Soderbergh, he's a fan of film and has lifted shots, and he's actually talked about doing so on Criterion supplements. So it happens, right. And I think it's more interesting when he does it because it's kind of like, he's paying homage to the shot, but he's also saying, oh, hey, if you're a film buff, look what I just did.
Right. Yeah, and it's he's got his own stamp on it. He's still doing his own thing. I mean, he's certainly a technical director. He sets things up ahead of time. He knows what he wants before he's even filming. And I know Nancy Allen, his wife at the time, refers to that somehow. Everything is completely composed. So I'm guessing maybe there aren't a lot of takes necessary, for someone like him, but.
Yeah, we talked about Haneke as being a precise filmmaker. He's maybe not as precise, but probably somewhere in between, Haneke and Brett Ratner. That's just a random Hollywood director off the top of my head. But yeah, you could pick many.
Yeah, yeah, and he's got. I like his sense of kind of a super reality. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's easier to comprehend, easier to follow along, but it is a heightened reality. I think that's really that mix of Hitchcock and the Italian giallo films. To me, it's a mix of those two, and you know, the giallo films kind of give it that super reality. It's not surreal. It's just a super reality. It's not quite, you know, it's certainly not neorealism, but
no,
you know,
it's for not, sure. You don't see a lot of taxi cab scenes like that in a De Sica film.
Right.
It's interesting. I think kind of like Tarantino, he takes a lot of influences and just kind of distills them into his own style. And he does. I'd say he, you know, we always ask, is so-and-so an auteur? And I'd say he most certainly is, but he's not a copycat auteur. And this, I'd say the same for Tarantino too. You know, Tarantino is even more obvious in his influences, but you know, few people would debate whether he's an auteur. Actually, some people would. Spike Lee would.
Yeah, I had, it's interesting. I was thinking about that before and thinking, was, you know, is De Palma an auteur? And you know, I guess you're right. He probably is. I've had more trouble getting there, I guess, because of his influences. Just seems like he just wears them on his sleeve so much, but yeah. No, you're probably right.
And he does do genre films mostly, or you know, he doesn't do really a whole lot of true art films. Whereas it's not fair to compare him to Tarantino, but Tarantino does, you know, he's influenced by Godard as well. Well, you know, probably De Palma is too. You know, we talked about the Odessa Steps. That's Eisenstein. So
yeah, Eisenstein. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He just works them into genre and popular Hollywood productions. So I'd say The Untouchables is a really good movie.
It is. Yeah. And you know, people love, I enjoy Scarface, you know, even though it is so violent and just so over the top. I can't help but not enjoy the film. I can understand how people would be down on it, but I don't know. I really like those films. I think for De Palma, some of my favorites really get back to the early stuff. I mean, I've seen Sisters on Hulu. I liked it quite a bit. Haven't seen Obsession, but Carrie, Dressed to Kill. I would say Blowout might even be my favorite. I just love the use of sound in that film. You know, except for maybe the ending. We can get into how De Palma ends his films maybe a little bit later, but
I don't think I've seen Blowout. I own it, but I don't. Mm. I think I might have seen it when I was younger, like this one, but I haven't revisited. So,
oh yeah.
So yeah, don't tell me the ending.
I will not. So why don't we just touch on the acting a little bit? I mean, I mentioned the actors that are in the film. Again, Angie Dickinson, Michael Caine, Nancy Allen, Keith Gordon, Dennis Franz, the main ones. So any that kind of stand out to you, and how did it feel? How did they feel interacting with each other?
Well, I really liked Angie Dickinson and Michael Caine together. I thought they were good. And Dickinson, of course, the museum scene, which we'll talk about, you know, it's almost a silent it's almost a silent performance.
Mm-hmm.
She's emoting with her face and not really with her dialogue, but I thought she did a good job. And Michael Caine, I think, is good in everything. He's Michael Caine.
Yeah, he's a rock.
I actually had trouble with the other three. Nancy Allen, especially. Yeah, I was not buying what she was selling.
Nope.
Keith Gordon, you know, became he had a pretty good career, but I also, you know, at times he was better than others. And then Dennis Franz, because I've watched TV since then.
Yeah. Kind of clouds that performance a bit, yeah.
And it's maybe not fair to Dennis Franz, because this is really where that role originated for him, and he was typecast for, you know, 15 years afterward. But I've watched TV, so I'm like, okay, it's NYPD Blue meets Argento meets Hitchcock.
Yeah, I'm right with you. I mean, I had a little bit of trouble with some of Angie Dickinson's scenes. I call them the ecstasy scenes, where it wasn't quite believable for me.
Yeah.
Not that that really should take me out of the film, but it did a little bit. I mean, it's an important part. Same with Michael Caine. He was a rock. Nothing bad to say about him. He was great. And I had the same issues with Nancy Allen, Keith Gordon, Dennis Franz. I even, you know, noted I didn't really like the way the scenes where Nancy Allen and Keith Gordon's characters were interacting once they come together. Just, it almost took me out of the film. I just didn't really like their dynamic. I thought they were fine by themselves, especially the scenes where Keith Gordon's character is taking the pictures. Mm-hmm. You know, when he's on his own doing his thing, I like what he's doing, yep. But otherwise, yeah, not so much.
Well, I felt the same way, and I actually pulled a clip I pulled this clip to show that these performances weren't tip top. So I might as well play that now. What do you think?
Let's do it. Yep.
Father, wonder where you are?
Well, he's not my father. He's my stepfather. Anyway, I told him I was spending the night at my friend Paul's and he'll cover for me.
Well, I'll take you home tomorrow.
No, I don't want to go home. Look, Miss Blake, I've got some pictures.
Call me Liz, okay?
Okay, Liz, I've got some pictures of that blonde from a camera I hid outside Elliot's office. Now we got to get in, get Elliot's appointment book, and get her name.
That's what the police are for. Come on, let's talk to Marino.
Fine, you talk to Marino. I'm going to find out the blonde's name.
Who do you think you are, Superman? You're just a kid, for God's sake.
Yeah, I'm the kid that saved your life.
So, yeah, Nancy Allen is, I don't know if I'd say overacting, but it seems like she's reading off a piece of paper or something. Maybe she was, but yeah, it seems artificial, and she has the same intonation each time. So, yeah, there are really two halves of the movie. There's the first half when, and Dickinson, I could see the complaints, but I thought she was at least passable.
Yeah.
But whereas the second half, I had a lot of trouble because it's primarily those two and them playing Nancy Drew and yeah, just every time they had an exchange with in dialogue, it took me out of the movie, and I was like, okay, can we bring Angie Dickinson back to life?
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, it was I guess probably her best performance, Nancy Allen's, was in the seduction scene with Michael Caine. I thought parts of that were well done, but overall, unfortunately, not so much. But yeah,
well,
you know,
her confidence really came out there.
Yeah, and yeah, that's a good point.
And maybe it's just because she was playing opposite Caine. I'd say that she probably raised her game for that. Whereas Gordon was a newcomer, a youngster, and yeah, who knows. No. And of course, she was married to the director, so what's he going to say?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Who knows? But I mean, but like we said, there is just that where he isn't necessarily, De Palma isn't necessarily about those characters. It's really, kind of that just that type, so to speak, and really the mood of the film. So I guess, you know, maybe they didn't need to be as good.
Well, you know, we talked about Giallo. In an Argento film, in Suspiria, in Deep Red, you're not going to find the best acting in the world.
No,
in fact, usually they're dubbed, and sometimes rather poorly. So
yeah,
maybe he just doesn't care. I'm harping on Nancy Allen. From what I hear, she's actually one of the nicer people you could meet in Hollywood off screen. So I feel bad, and she has been better than this in other films. But yeah, in this one, it just really didn't work for me. So
yeah, unfortunate.
But, apologies, Nancy.
Yeah. Sorry, Nancy. We still enjoyed the movie. So
yeah,
And it's a good point that you brought up. I mean, I think sometimes maybe even rewatching these movies, you can get past the acting, say in this, or like, you know, something like Suspiria. I mean, like you said, it's about the mood, the atmosphere. It's not about the acting.
Right. It's about the colors and the
yeah.
And none of it's,
it does take a little bit to get past that at first. You just kind of got to set that aside. But yeah, once you're, you know, invested, it's, you know, it's easy to be all in.
I think that's the case with a lot of Giallo. I think you do. Really, there's no great acting. And because of the dubbing, it's, you know, it's really not something you think about. You could even go as far as saying that with spaghetti Westerns. You know, they...
Sure.
You know, Clint was great. And, but you... It tends to be more, facial acting rather than verbal acting.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, speaking of acting, we do have to talk a little bit about the sexuality in this film. It's prevalent from the very beginning. So, I mean, what did you think?
Beginning. And also, the question is, who's acting and who's
right?
When is it the actress? And yeah. For this period of time, it's pretty steamy, as
yeah,
as a good friend would say.
Yeah, it really is.
Actually, I mean, and it's literally steamy.
Yeah, from the beginning and the end. I mean, there is the bookend of the mm-hmm. the shower scenes, but geez, yeah. I mean, it's almost surprising with how steamy this is. I mean, De Palma obviously didn't think it was that steamy. This unrated cut that's out there now is the one that he wanted, but he had to cut it down. I mean, I don't know. I wanted to ask him, you know, Mr. De Palma, I mean, did you really think that the genital shots were going to get past the censors?
I know. Gosh. And there is a supplement where he was complaining about that. And really, yeah. This was early 80s. What did you expect?
Right. Right.
And really,
I mean, it's nice. He pushed the boundary, you know, for sure. And I mean, it's great that he, you know, decided to go there, but great, I guess. But.
And if it, yeah, if it came out today, I think it would be a solid R. The uncut yeah. version, I think, would be, you know, we're almost sanitized to it desensitized to it. Yeah.
It's true.
The early 80s, if that cut was out there, you know, every schoolboy would have watched that movie. So,
yeah, I think they still did anyway, but yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, did you think obviously for the time, but I mean, rewatching it now, Aaron, what did you, mm-hmm. how did you feel about it?
I mean, I wasn't offended if that's what you're asking. Yeah. I guess the question is more, do I think it, was necessary, you know? And I think,
yeah, I mean, does it belong? Does it, you know, does it take you out of the film? Was it that shocking? You know?
I'd say it was fine. I think because of the way it begins and ends, and because of the way the genesis with the twist and the confrontation with Nancy Allen. I mean, really, the whole mm-hmm. whole movie is about sexuality, and so yeah, I think it fits fine.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think so too. I mean, it didn't bother me at all. I wasn't super surprised just knowing going into this that they were trying to, avoid an X rating by cutting it down from the unrated version. So had a sense there was something, but yeah, I mean, it's because of just how, Angie Dickinson's character is dealing with sexuality at that point. Mm-hmm. It kind of made sense to go there, you know, and get to that level. And of course there's the somewhat violence in the shower too. So.
Oh, right. Yeah. And that's another, we talk about the nudity, the violence, you know, there's much worse in R-rated movies. I mean, pick any Eli Roth movie, and it's
sure.
you know, it's yep. much, much worse. But yeah, the violence was also censored, almost as much as the nude scenes, and the violence was actually not too shocking. In fact, I've seen worse in giallo movies.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and this is the kind of thing back in 1980. They didn't release these unrated cuts like you get in a DVD now. You know, so it's right. like you get in the theater, you get the R-rated cut, you get the unrated cut when it comes to video. So, you know, I'm sure that's what would happen if it mm-hmm. was, you know, released today. So
yeah, uncensored, limited edition. no, they would have made right. a killing off it today.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I think the unrated would have just come out in theaters and been no problem.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, with the way it is now, I could see that. So, and early on, we have another clip. Maybe we should just transition with a clip. This is Dr. Elliot with Angie Dickinson's character. I forget her name, but they have a therapy session that gets you into the head of Angie's character a little bit, where she's coming from, how she's frustrated. So why don't we go ahead and play that?
And it's a little long, this clip, but I thought about cutting it down because of that reason. But Michael Caine and Angie Dickinson, it's such a great scene, and it marries mm-hmm. the two main themes with sexuality and therapy. So here you go.
How are things going with Mike?
Fine.
Good.
No, they're not fine. What a dumb word that is. He gave me one of his wham-bang specials this morning, and I'm mad at him. Isn't that right? Shouldn't I be mad?
Yeah. Did you tell him?
What?
That you were mad at him.
Of course not. I moaned with pleasure at his touch. Isn't that what every man wants?
I don't know. Is it?
Don't start that stuff with me.
Don't you think you'd feel better if you snapped at Mike instead of me? Think about where your anger is going.
I'm sorry.
Stop apologizing and tell Mike he makes you mad.
Tell him he stinks in bed?
Does he?
Yes.
Then tell him.
Maybe there's something wrong with me.
There's nothing wrong with you.
Do you find me attractive?
Of course.
Would you want to sleep with me?
Yes.
Then why don't you?
Because I love my wife, and sleeping with you isn't worth jeopardizing my marriage. Is it worth it to you to jeopardize yours?
I don't know.
So, yeah, I mean, Michael Caine, Dr. Ellie, he seems like such a I don't know. I think he's a thoughtful therapist. I think early on you don't really see anything wrong. I mean, it's a good setup with what's going on, I think. I think rewatching after seeing the entire film, of course, adds a dimension to this scene. But, you know, you get to know Dr. Ellie, get to know A.G. Dickinson's character and, you know, where they're coming from, what their, you know, frustrations are. And, you know, he like I said, he does seem like at least a professional at this point.
Well, do many therapists say they would sleep with their clients? Is that something that happens?
Oh, sure. Of course. At least he looked in the mirror, you know, to kind of, you know, consider himself. But
sure. Yeah.
And of course that's an ongoing motif. He's that happens more than once, and he kind of looks at himself, takes a little glance to kind of, you know, consider where he is and what he thinks about it. But.
And that actually does speak to the twist, and I think it's actually that part is excellent. But the actual therapy itself, I think it's interesting. Really, we have the two therapy scenes. We have they both involve sexuality. Then we have the Angie and the Nancy one, and that's Kate and Liz are the characters.
Kate and Liz, right.
Yeah, their names don't come up that much though.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's, you know, it's a like you said, it's mostly a silent film.
Yeah, well, so aside from those few, the dialogue scenes there, the police station, you know, and of course the bad dialogue between Nancy Allen and Keith Gordon. I think that, you know, him injecting the theme of therapy with sexuality is interesting. You know, yeah, I'm not a Freud expert, but I think there's a little Freudian references there.
Sure.
So yeah, of course Kate, the character, is sexually repressed. She is, she's not satisfied at home. We see, you know, her sexual escapade and the shower scene, that could be some sort of fantasy in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Liz, Nancy Allen's character, is extremely sexually liberated. She's, you know, very, very forward. Well, actually, Kate is forward, you know, more forward than she would expect herself to be. And maybe that was a comfort. Maybe she felt more comfortable in therapy with Michael Caine. I mean, wouldn't you?
Certainly.
But there's a contrast, I think, and therapy kind of bookends we have Liz sexually repressed, and then she's looking for adventure and she finds it, and then we have Liz, who is sexually expressive, and she is
trying to stay alive. Staying alive.
Trying to using actually sex as a weapon to try to, you know, in that final scene with Caine, mm-hmm. She's trying to set him up, and the two scenes pair well because they both invoke sexuality, and they both have a lady propositioning her therapist, and it seems like he thinks about it both occasions.
Both times. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, it's another bookend. We've got the bookend of the shower scenes, and then as we move in a little bit closer, we've got the two therapy scenes. So yeah, he likes his kind of framing, Mr. De Palma.
And I think he should. Michael Caine should have more male clients.
That probably would have helped him. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you're right. So should we talk about the museum scene? I mean, this is one of the most iconic, if not the most iconic scene in the film.
Oh, we have to, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about a silent movie. You know, it's about, well, from I kind of timed it a little bit. It looks like it's about 10 minutes long, you know, really from start to the taxi. But I think when you really get the kind of the cat and mouse chase, it's really about 6 minutes long. But
that makes sense.
That's
yeah.
quite a bit of, you know, scenes with no dialogue. And, you know, we should say this is Kate. Of course, she's gone to the museum and she's looking at paintings, but really more than the paintings, looking at the people around her. And she sees a boyfriend and girlfriend kind of flirting a little bit. We see a woman who is being hit on. We also see a family, so it brings in the family dynamic, whereas, you know, she's a wife and mother, so that's something else she's got to be, you know, kind of considering. So she's sitting there in the museum, kind of, as we think, considering her own life and where she wants to go. And
she wants to go in the taxi cab.
She's going to follow this mysterious stranger. And yeah, that man comes in, and that's really, they're giving glances, and he kind of shuns her a little bit. And, she shows her ring, and she thinks that's maybe the reason why he walks off. And of course, she's got to follow him through the museum. And it's a really nice piece, some of the best music, I think, in the
great
film.
Great music, yeah. And in fact, yeah. I'd say the whole film has some tremendous music. I really like the score. You know, what's interesting is during school, we had a seminar, you know, an evening where there was a speaker and a presentation. And this person, he was from somewhere in Eastern Europe. I forget which school, maybe Vienna. And he had done a bunch of film research just on museums and film. And so he played like this hour-long clip that was just clips of different films with museums. And, you know, Vertigo was in there. I'm trying to remember. Of course, this was in there. I remember this.
Sure.
You probably haven't seen Illustrious Corpses. There's a very important scene there. I'd recommend it. It's a great movie. But this scene, those films, he played short clips, you know, maybe 30 seconds to a minute, whereas this film, he played the same scene, not in its entirety, but he cut around it. So I think he felt it was important enough as a, you know, just representing a museum. And yeah, I think it is, from a filmmaking standpoint, I think it is a tremendous scene. Using the with the use of music, mise-en-scene, using the paintings, using the people, the acting, you know, even though they weren't speaking any lines, I think both of them, their expressions were terrific and added to the scene.
Yeah.
And they looked the part too.
Yeah, definitely.
The guy looked a little, you know, like a random pickup kind of guy. And I don't know what they look like, but
I know, I was going to say, whatever they look like, he was that guy. So, you know, wonder where he came from. And yeah, it's a great scene. It ends well too, you know, afterwards, because you get a little glimpse of Bobby there. Whether you see it or not, you may not see it till the second time. But
right.
Yeah, it's quite a piece. And like you said, love the music leading up to that. So yeah, great work. I think it might have been one of the supplements where De Palma feels like that's one of his best scenes. Well, I know the elevator scene. Of course, he felt was one of his best too. Anything to say about the elevator scene?
I think that's a great scene as well. Yeah, I did quibble about the acting, but I think there are certain sequences here that are masterful. And I'd say this one is one. The elevator scene is terrific. The uncut, especially. We did see the comparison,
the uncut's more impactful.
Deserved to be
for sure.
seen. Yeah. And then the police station scene, I thought, and there's lots of little tidbits. You mentioned the mirrors with Michael Caine. There's a lot of use of mirrors with, you know, not just with Caine, although often with Caine, but other actors. There's mirrors are a motif. And
in the elevator, where she catches a glimpse of Bobby there, and yeah.
And there's a lot of like split screen shots, and some like multi split screen. You know, when he was watching the television with the transgender Phil Donahue. You know, that's like almost four shots in one frame.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. Watching that again, just how didn't realize at first, but both Dr. Elliot Liz are watching the same thing, and it kind of comes together at the end. And like you said, it's a split frame. And you mentioned too, and I know this is a favorite of De Palma, is that really kind of it's not a split screen or really, but it's almost like a split frame, but it's a foreground background, I guess I'd call it, with deep focus, where both the background and the foreground are in focus. And he uses that in the police station.
Right. Yeah, that's different. Yeah. That's where the characters are situated. Opposite from each other, you have the Keith Gordon in the middle, and then you have Nancy Allen in the background, and then Franz and Kane in the foreground. Yeah, that was also masterful, I'd say. I was actually, that was again one of my favorite segments. And actually, I have a clip here. Well, it doesn't really, it doesn't speak to the visual quality of this film, but this was some of the better dialogue. Anytime Kane was on screen speaking to somebody, it was good. And so maybe I should play this clip with Kane talking to Dennis Franz in his cop voice.
Sure.
There's all kinds of ways to get killed in this city, if you're looking for it.
Well, yes, she did have a problem about her sexual worth. And this morning, she asked me if I was attracted to her.
Yeah, but you're not a psycho. You do know some, though, don't you, Doc?
Yes, of course. I do some work at Bellevue.
Hey, could she have met one of these nuts at your office? I mean, some kind of weirdo she could have turned on that might have followed her?
The term we use, Detective Marino, is not weirdo, but a person suffering from emotional dysfunction and a problem of maladaption. And they never come to my office.
Are you sure? How about a new patient?
I mean, how do you know how nuts they are until you see them?
Well, of course, that's possible, but it's hardly likely.
Doctor, you're not protecting one of your patients now, are you?
Absolutely not.
Well, Doc, you got to look at it my way. See, we got no leads. Except a witness out there who maybe should take
a look at all your patients that were around that morning. And that way I can be absolutely sure that my,
weirdo isn't your, person suffering from emotional dysfunctions and problems of maladaption.
So yeah, that scene, there's a lot going on in that one point. Yeah, we know that, Keith Gordon, I forget his character's name, I'll look it up. Petey. That's right, because they make the double entendre joke
early on with his contraption there. Yep.
Peter is listening in, and then of course that's when we're first really getting to know Liz, Nancy Allen, and we don't know that she's a prostitute yet, but it does, actually that's I think when the film is divided. That scene, it goes from Kane and Kate to Peter and Liz.
Showing him listening. Yeah, it's a nice. I like the quote in there too. Of course, you mentioned Kane. He says people suffering from emotional dysfunction and a problem of maladaption. And of course, they say that a couple of times, which I think would be kind of a hard line to say. But I, with that scene, there is a. I remember it also being, and I mentioned it being a favorite of De Palma, and I know there's a scene in Blowout, I think it's early on in the accident scene, where you see John Travolta's character in the background and then the foreground shot of the owl. And it's not a split screen, but it just almost looks like it is. But it's just that kind of background foreground shot that I think is a favorite and really a staple of De Palma. It's one of those things when I see that I think of a De Palma film. So
yeah, there were some actual split screen shots though. With the panties and the phone calls. I did pull some images, which of course they're on Facebook. So I think there are some of those in the images. And actually, since it's such a visual movie, the images actually look pretty amazing.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, it's a good. good pictures there. So this film, you know, we talked about how the unrated version with the sex and the violence was really could have been ahead of its time, and there is a transgender theme in this film. We see it in the television scene, as you mentioned, and we also see it with the Bobby character. And so, you know, was this film really ahead of its time, do you think, Aaron? I mean, would it be less controversial now as it comes out? I mean, I think there's this issue has been tackled much more. I mean, it's much more prominent, I guess you could say. But, mm-hmm. you know, how would it be different now?
Well, you know, we're in the Caitlyn Jenner era now.
Exactly.
And that's on one side. And then we have the South Park making fun of Caitlyn Jenner on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
So there, and we have the anti-PC. I think it's actually, I think it is ahead of its time, but I think transgenderism was unique enough and different enough that it worked as a twist back then, whereas now, you know, and you watch it now, you see it coming a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I did see the film before, I didn't remember the twist.
I didn't either. I didn't see it coming.
You didn't?
Nope.
Okay. All right. I picked up on little Bobby.
yeah. I should have, but much. Nope, I didn't.
Yeah, so I don't know if I'd say ahead of its time, but I would say that it would be more accepted now. It was more strange in 1980. What year was this film? 81?
Yeah, I noted 80, but I think you're right. I think it's 81. No, it is 1980, sorry. 81 is Blowout, so 1980.
So for 1980.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think this certainly was, important. And going back to it now, I guess I would just say I agree with you. I don't think it would be as controversial now. I thought it was interesting. The initial plan was to actually have a castration scene at the beginning, which, you know, that would have been that much more shocking. However,
wow,
they
had
shown that. I don't know how that would have fit in with the initial shower scene. But yeah, if they put that in there, that would have been quite the scene. But yeah, I think it's it was an interesting to see it tackled in 1980, I was a little bit surprised, really, by that, and welcomed it. So.
Yeah, I think in the other direction, I think it would be too politically incorrect to make a transgender person with this mistaken identity a killer, and I think people would actually probably protest this movie if it were made today.
Well, yeah, I didn't think about that, but you're probably right. Yep.
So.
Different time. 30,
different times.
35
yeah,
years.
Can't judge the movie based on today and vice versa.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Got to watch it in the time it came out. So, and the I'd mentioned before the amateur detectives. We've got Liz and Peter who get together and are trying to determine who killed his mother. And so, and I had mentioned before how I didn't really find their relationship that compelling when they were on screen, but I, curious to see, what did you think about those, Aaron? I did mention how I actually thought that Peter's scene when he's by himself taking the pictures, that was compelling. It's another instance where we saw the background foreground again, or was it a split screen with the stopwatch? Sure how they did that, but
yeah. I'd have to watch it again.
Yeah, it was a really nice cut because it looks like it could have been either way. I could see someone making an argument either way, but it's a nice, really nice, again, almost silent screen scene again because it's just him, kind of setting up how he's going to do the investigation. But that was him on his own. So.
Yeah, I think I liked the movie when it was when the two of them weren't talking. I liked it a lot more. And again, we're getting back to the acting. But yeah, I think this segment's weaker than the beginning segment. I don't really know what else I can say.
Yeah,
it had its moments, but well, actually, there was one interesting thing about it, which even though it wasn't very well acted, the whole idea of sexual chemistry between Keith Gordon and Nancy Allen,
mm-hmm.
Was there any?
Yeah.
She was very I don't want to say a loose woman, but she was very. Aggressive woman.
Yeah.
Whereas he is a kid and, who knows his experience, but definitely is not up to hers. And you kind of wonder if, you know, there was something brewing there.
Yeah, it certainly seemed like it. It doesn't seem like, you know, De Palma necessarily went anywhere with it, but it's certainly there on screen. I mean, you see it even in the, what's it, the next to the last scene there, or close to it, where they're in the restaurant, and he invites her over, and she says sure. So yeah, they have the, certainly have that that possibility. So yeah, it's interesting.
He might be in 1980. He might not have been able to go there. You know, that a child,
yeah.
Well, and prostitute, that might have been risky for the rating as well. So, but I think it's kind of implicit,
yeah,
that there was something brewing there.
Yeah.
So yeah, they weren't just you know, going around being detectives, but you know, they might have been into each other a little bit.
Yeah.
I know if I were Keith Gordon, I would be I would be all for that. But.
Sure, yeah, why not? Especially as a young boy. So yeah, he's pretty much the age I think that I would have been you know, would have watched this movie at the same time. So
right, although he did just lose his mother, and you know, he's chasing down the killer. So
right.
Maybe it didn't need to be there.
He does have that going for him. So
yeah. But I don't really think that's. I just think that made their interactions just a little more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't really add much to the story. You know, it just again reinvigorated that it was all about sex.
Right.
And sex is on your mind if you're watching this movie, and really in every scene.
Yeah, the entire thing. Yep. No, you're right. Yep. Permeates the whole thing. So, yeah. I would just mention, too, just from the scenes, one that stood out to me, I did like the subway scene quite a bit.
Right.
It gets back to De Palma a little bit, but it's really where, you know, he understands suspense and how, you know, the things that are unexpected or just these little pieces where you see where she's getting on the subway and you see Bobby jump on the subway. So, you know, she's there.
Right.
And then you cut to the scene where you see the, which I think she calls them thugs, that have also gotten on the, you know, the
little
train,
racist.
So. Yeah.
Just a smidge.
Yeah. So that might have played differently today.
Yes.
So, yeah.
You know, I think that was, again, yeah, that was an effective scene. Although, yeah, just because I'm watching it in 2015, I did feel a little weird watching the way she interacted with the African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yep.
A little racist.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Anything else to mention about Dress to Kill before we get into our kind of our ratings and the supplements, Aaron?
I think we've talked it really the whole film out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all laid there. So what would you give?
Artistic thriller.
What would you give the Dress to Kill as an overall film rating?
This is a tough one. I don't know if you feel the same way, but it did lose me a little bit in the second half, but there are some tremendous, amazing shots. And so I was always visually interested.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, and actually I liked it a little more upon reflection because I think of the museum shot and the police station shot and the elevator.
Yeah.
So I'm going to give it a 7, and I think that's pretty generous, actually.
Yep. I could agree with you there. My rating's the same. I think, like you said, you kind of pull away from the film, and obviously the acting is there as a negative, but the you know, the technical aspects of it is there as a positive. And the suspense, I mean, the guy knows how to put a film together overall. So, you know, from a quality standpoint, technical standpoint, it certainly kept it at a 7, but I could go down to a 6. I would mention too, I just don't know about endings in Brian De Palma films. I mean, this is another one that it was okay, but you know, did we the dream sequence and the, mm-hmm. you know, the sequence in the asylum, it didn't quite land for me. It just kind of, they seemed a little bit out of left field and, you know.
Kind of a bailout.
Yeah. It's similar with Blowout too. Like I just loved how that movie is really wound up pretty tight and really tense, but then the ending is just kind of, again, I'm not going to say what happens, but just from what I remember, it's been a while. It's kind of rote, just kind of, you know, a little deflating, I guess, but
yeah, I think they should have given Keith Gordon a machine gun and done a Say Hello to My Little Friend.
That would have been great.
Yeah, he did end it in that one pretty well. But
it
wasn't. And a couple of weeks ago, we talked about Haneke and how mm-hmm. he likes to leave something there. De Palma does try to wrap things up as much as he can. I think you're right. I think his endings are weak as a result.
Yeah.
Even though the shower scene, I mean, well, he does kind of just say that was a dream,
Right.
That was not reality. And so, yeah.
It seems like kind of a cop-out. It's just, I don't know. It didn't, yeah. it didn't you know, have that overall effect. It is, as I said before, it's a nice bookend, shower to shower. But other than that, mm-hmm. And it is tense. I mean, you're wondering what's happening, and you get sure. the sense that he's escaped. But finding out what happens, not so much.
Maybe a little Hollywood.
Yeah, sure. So what about the supplements? I mean, there are quite a few on here. Let's talk about those a bit. You know, we get from there's a interview, a number of interviews, and which I think yeah. is really great. We've got a De Palma interview. There's one with Nancy Allen. These are all new mm-hmm. With producer George Lito, Pino Donaggio. I hope I got your name correctly. The Italian composer. Also, Victoria Lynn Johnson, she was the body double in the first shower scene.
Hey, it was interesting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. One with Stephen Sayadian, I believe it is. He was a one-sheet poster artist. That was mm-hmm. you know, really, really great. I enjoyed that one quite a bit.
Different, yeah.
Yeah, haven't seen
it. No, I liked all these. That. And you know, I mentioned Nancy Allen. She seems like a very, very nice, chummy person.
Yeah.
So she did come off that way, and I actually felt bad. I was like, I hate your acting. But, she said she did a lot of work on the character, and I was like, did you?
Where was the work? I don't. Yeah. Who knows? It's unfortunate.
She might have been a little miscast too as a prostitute. She kind of has that baby face look. You know.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's true. I didn't really think of that, but yeah, I did like. There was one other shot that I just wanted to mention. I thought was kind of iconic. It does come up in here at one point. It's in the booklet too. The shot with the on the elevator where you see the after the first swipe, and right. you see the razor, and you know, the face of Bobby is blurry. It's just really great.
That's great.
Yeah, one of the iconic, yeah. just regular shots. But I know that was mentioned in some of the interviews. But mm-hmm. But some nice working relationships were talked about. You know, like with the producer George Lito, who worked with De Palma, and of course Donaggio was the composer for a number of his films. But it was interesting how because I always kind of gravitate to some of the composers, how Donaggio, he wanted to do some of the films for De Palma, like Mission Impossible or, you know, some of his more Hollywood films, maybe Scarface but, you know, he really wanted Donaggio for the, these kind of, you know, these thriller movies. Which mm-hmm. you know, is understandable. I know he did Obsession, and he was there for Blowout. So,
and he was he had scored Don't Look Now,
right?
The Nicholas Roeg film, and you know, speaking of sex, that might be how he got the job. He's right? Like, okay, I want a sexual thriller. you know, hey, here's one.
Yeah.
No, I thought the interviews were all pretty good. And De Palma was interviewed by Noah Baumbach.
Yeah. Who that was great.
So it was a little more of a conversation, and they did address the Hitchcock. That's where he defended himself a little bit, and he mentioned he got the idea because he saw that Donahue transsexual piece, and then of course there's the Hitchcock stuff. You know, mm-hmm. there's the comparison to Psycho, and they actually didn't address it directly, but it's again sort of hinted at that you know, with the character being bumped off early, you know, that he wanted that, and you kind of wonder if he's trying to emulate Psycho or
a lot of it there. I mean, yeah, the shower scenes and just, you know, the music too. You know, you've got the strings. I mean, they originally wanted, or I think it was for Obsession that De Palma wanted to have Bernard Herrmann, but you know, did mm-hmm. settle on Donaggio after that. So, yeah, there's an interesting piece even in the within the museum scene. It was a little bit distracting for me because the theme sounds at the very beginning like the main theme from The Last of the Mohicans, scored by Randy Edelman. Have you seen that?
Oh, I love that score. I like the movie, but the score is exceptional.
Yeah.
And that score was used in film classes many times because it's cut to the film.
Yes.
Or to the action. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, a lot of good the interviews I think were the best part of the disc, and actually even the body double, you know, that
interesting
body doubles probably happen more often than we realize it. It's kind of interesting that they would go there and get her to talk about it. But yeah. I guess she was, this was known back in the day.
Right. Yeah. It became big news, I guess. So it's even part of Trivial Pursuit, Baby Boomer edition.
Right.
So, yeah. It's funny.
And hearing her reaction too, you know, this, she was a magazine girl and doing a film, and what that's like, that transition. That was fascinating, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, and the
interview, he awkwardly says, "Do you mind disrobing?"
Yeah,
but of course he has to.
right.
You know, that's her job.
Part of the job. Yeah, and I like the interview with Stephen Sayadian. How, you know, he's the one sheet poster guy, and there's a lot of, he got to start with dildo print ads. And made his work there, but
Hustler magazine too. Yeah,
yep, Hustler magazine, and
that's another influence of De Palma's.
Yeah, exactly.
Hitchcock and Hustler.
I love how, I mean, kudos to Criterion for getting those two, you know, as interviews. It's really, really good work. I like that he also made the connection, of course, to the Graduate, the one sheet of Dressed to Kill
legs.
Has the legs comparison to the Graduate. That was a nice kind of tie in for a title we're getting in a few months here, so very cool.
And I think the poster is important as a marketing piece too. I was trying to recall, did we actually see the legs like that in the film?
No.
Maybe when she's
I don't think
so.
We do.
I think they were manufactured, but yeah, I think it does capture the gist of the film.
Yeah, you know, you get the guy, you know, in the background,
a sexual thriller.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the shoes.
Although she. She's not the one that's dressed to kill, but...
right. Yeah.
You don't want to see the legs of the one that actually is dressed to kill.
Not so much. There are some other pieces from 2001. There's the making of Dressed to Kill. That is in there. And some of the other interviews, there's an appreciation with Keith Gordon. That's from 2001. So they kind of tied in some of the previous special features onto this disc, so it's pretty chock full. Even the storyboards, which they're a little crude, and they show that De Palma is not an artist, but you know, he can draw enough to, you know, kind of visualize what he wants to do. So
again, not like Haneke, where they're meticulous, but no, he gets to where he needs to be. And again, you know, the ratings. There were two pieces with about the nudity and the violence, which were a little redundant. Actually, the second piece, the version comparison, which showed the X, I'm sorry, the R, and then the unrated, and then the TV version.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I didn't even think they needed that. The slashing Dressed to Kill, where really they just complained about the cuts.
Right.
I thought the comparison was strong enough.
Kind of cut it, covered it. Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, they could have maybe just given some voiceover and said the same things, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's neat to, you know, see it. And there's like three scenes that they really called out, you know, within mm-hmm. that. But yeah, little bit redundant. And I mean, it's a good word to use, because even some of the like the making of Dressed to Kill, a little bit redundant with some of what De Palma is saying. But you know, there's some other. Sure. It's a longer piece. It's, I think it's about 43 minutes. So you know, has some other, you know, important pieces in there. So yeah, I mean, overall, what kind of rating would you give the supplements, Aaron? What do you think?
I think there were a good many, and you know, again, redundant but interesting, all of them. So I would give it an 8.
Yeah,
total.
Nice.
Yeah.
I really wanted to give it a 9, because I think overall the new interviews are just lovely. You know, who they brought in there. There's a lot there. Of course, it doesn't have commentary, so that would be the one thing that would maybe even make it a 10 for me. But I could give it a 9 just overall, except for, you know, without having a commentary. So
okay,
so if we're gonna give it an overall,
I don't know, does De Palma do commentaries?
I don't know, it's a good question. He seems like a guy, again, with all he spoke about on this this disc, you'd think he would, but
I would love a De Palma commentary. Yeah. I think that would be an honest one, where he talks about where he got this shot and where he got that shot. I don't know if he does, but Brian De Palma, if you're listening, do one.
Yes, would love to hear it. So I guess I'm with you overall. I mean, I'd like to. I think the supplement's going to bump this up a little bit. I think the interviews are just lovely. Love the. I think the. I wanted to note too that the cinematographer Ralph Bode, he actually went to the University of Vermont. So a little hometown boy there. So
neat.
Nice to see that. And so overall, I mean, I think I'd give it an 8 for a Criterion rating. I think the supplements do make the film better, a little more appreciation. I think picture quality overall is pretty good. There's a few grainy scenes. I think it's just the film stock and, you know, whatever particular shot they had. So yeah, I'm with you. It's an overall pretty solid 8, and that's a pretty good rating for a film that we gave a 7. So
yeah, I think it's important, and I would recommend picking it up if you're not, if you don't care about nudity and that sort of thing.
All right, Aaron, so I have a feeling I know where you're going to go with this, but is this film worthy of the Criterion canon?
It's not. I think it's important just because there are those handful of important scenes, but again, it's flawed.
Yeah.
If you're on the fence, I'd pick it up. I think it's probably a good blind buy.
Yeah, certainly. You know, I'm hoping it's maybe a good seller for Criterion, but I'd agree. I don't think it's quite canon worthy. I mean, we're not talking, you know, Seven Samurai here, but yeah, it's a nice disc. I'm glad we got to delve into it and talk about it. And like we said, rich supplements. So it's a nice job by Criterion.
Now, if we were canonizing certain scenes, I would canonize the museum scene, but that's about the best it has going for it.
Sure. So. Yeah, maybe we'll add that to the site sometime, the canon scenes or something.
We won't. Too much work.
So that's Dress to Kill, 1980, from Brian De Palma, the Criterion release. So thank you again for listening to us. And we just wanted to close out, of course, letting folks know where they can find the show. You can find us at CriterionCloseUp.com. You can find the on Twitter at Criterion, at CriterionCU. And you can also find us on Facebook, Facebook.com/CriterionCloseUp. Aaron, where can folks find you?
I'm on Twitter, AWest505, and I guess I'll give my letterbox. It's DSNT.
Yeah, should certainly follow Aaron there. You can find me, Mark Kearney, there too on Letterboxd, MHURNE, and on Twitter at Mark Kearney. Thanks again for listening, and we just, you know, would love some more. We're almost to that 1,000 Facebook likes, so you can invite some more folks to like us on Facebook. Would love some more iTunes reviews and star ratings. I can certainly use those, so thank you in advance. And just wanted to close out by saying we are, as I mentioned at the top, we're going to be talking about the Apu trilogy some more. So we'll look forward to that upcoming. And so that's it. Criterion Close-Up, Episode 17. Thank you for listening. How's your beer?